Good morning. Good morning and happy Friday. My name is Sharon Hargrave, and I'm the director for the Boone Center for the Family here at Pennsylvania University. At the Boone Center for the Family, we're highly committed to helping people develop healthy relationship living. On the week of our lectures, we've had the honor to have this family track, which we enjoy bringing people that are experts in their field to come in and talk about different issues that we all experience in relationship. We've had some hard and difficult topics this week, like pornography and trauma. And today we get to talk about something as fun as parenting. After getting married, which was the best decision of my life, being a parent was another really positive decision. So we've had a really good time this week. We have one more session this afternoon. My husband and I will be leading an extended session on the issue of forgiveness. So we would encourage you, if you work with people in your church in any kind of leadership passion and deal a lot with people that have a hard time forgiving, we encourage you to come. It's really been interesting to me this week as I've listened to the different sessions and seminars of all the things that we've talked about, from singleness that we just talked about to trauma to parenting, that all of us carry issues of things that we need to talk about and need to heal from. So I encourage you to come join us this afternoon if you don't. I'm thrilled to have Dr. Connie Horton with us here today. I'm also thrilled that her husband and son are sitting in the back of the room. So when she makes comments about parenting, if you hear like a no way or absolutely not, or you know that it's from Josh. It's really fun to have them here. Connie and I have known each other for 5 years now, and I've asked Connie to speak for the Boone Center for the Family several times in the area of parenting. And there's never a time that people don't walk away really encouraged and excited about this journey that can be so much fun and bring so much stress and complications at the same time. So, Connie, we thank you for your time and for being with us this morning.
It's great to be here.
Can I move around if I can? Can you hear me okay?
Sure.
Can you hear me at the back? Just give me this. Crank it up if I need to. Every year, in my role as a counseling center director at the university, I get to speak to parents at new student orientation. And I'm happy to do that, of course, to tell them some thoughts about the letting go process, about the transition for them and their family, things they might want to think about as parenting emerging adults, things like be thoughtful how much cell phone contact you want, even though it's free. Do you really want to call them 10 times a day? Decisions like that, the letting go, the transition, etc. And I'm happy to do that, but I always wish I had seen them years ago. Because, sure, I hope a few little tips at that point are helpful or ease their anxieties or whatever. But the truth is, what really matters is years before. What they're going to do in the next few years, of course, can make a difference. I don't want to minimize it too much, but it pales in comparison to parenting over the years. So I always wish I could speak to them sooner. That's kind of my fantasy. And I wish it wouldn't be just parents, but that it could be all the different people that influence a child's development. Because, as we know, this cliche phrase, but it's cliche, it hangs around because it's true, it takes a village. So even as you think about me, think about what I'm saying today, I'd encourage you to think about your different roles. Certainly if you're parents, I hope this is directly relevant to that. But if you're grandparents or aunts or uncles, if you're Sunday school teachers or youth ministers, if you're aunts or uncles or neighbors or school teachers or coaches, you have so many ways to influence children's development. So anytime I teach a parent in class, I like to start with Stephen Covey's, one of his habits from the highly effective people, begin with the end in mind. Basically, where are you trying to go? Or we could take it from Proverbs, right? Train up children in the way that they should go and they won't depart from them. You want to start with the end in mind, with the goal. Where are you trying to go? What do you want for them?
Where do you want them to go? Think about your kids or kids that you care about. What are your goals in parenting well so that when they come to college and beyond, they're in good shape? What would you say goes on? Parenting toward what?
Independence.
Relationship with God.
Relationship with God.
Independent thought.
Independent thought.
Not just, yeah.
Not just so individual, but also able to think on their own. Anything else?
Emotional awareness.
Emotional awareness.
Able to provide for their families.
Okay. Basic skills, ability to provide for their families.
Ability to choose a good nursing home for you.
That's really important. That's the first one I've heard. That's great. But seriously, it is important to kind of think about to what end. Because parenting is going to be different depending on the goals. Is your goal to have them be highly dependent on you throughout your whole life? Nobody ever really says that. But they may be parenting as if to create that. Or, you know, are you parenting them to be able to individuate? Are you parenting them to expect easy lives? To think life always goes the way you want? Or are you parenting them in a way that will help them be resilient? Because sometimes life's hard. And then what do we think faith has to do with all this? So I want you to think about college specifically. So imagine you had an influence, whether it's somebody that you're parenting, a child that you're parenting, or whether it's someone from your youth group or whoever that you have influence on. What do you hope their college life will be like? Can you give a few examples of what would be, oh yeah, they're doing well. I'm glad for them. Maybe variations of what we just talked about, but think specifically college. Yes.
I like that. What was our insistence that they got to AC for at least 2 years to get, I want to say, to be tested.
Okay.
That was our
thing
to do.
Okay. You wanted them to have more development in those areas.
Exactly.
Be exposed to different cultures.
Exposed to different cultures, great. To learn to live among people who are different than they.
Confident for my girls to know that they can, with their studies, pursue what they think they know, what they think they want, but okay to know. It's okay to say this probably it might not be it, and know when they should probably have that discussion and change that.
Yeah. The average college student changes something like 5 times,
right.
But many people.
Not to be afraid to say it's too late, right?
Right, yeah. How could they know at 18 all that they need in them? Yeah, good. I want to talk specifically about the world of mental health and maybe some things that you don't want for your sons and daughters and people that you care about. I'll give you a little warning. The next few slides are pretty disturbing. There's nothing graphic in them, don't worry, but it's pretty heavy news, actually. The college mental health picture is pretty serious right now, pretty concerning. And so I'd like to talk honestly about that and then think about, okay, how can we change this trend? Because it's a pretty strong trend. We see it here, we see it nationally. So this book was written in 2005 by Richard Cadison, who's essentially my counterpart at Harvard. He's the chief mental health officer at Harvard when he wrote this. And he talked about the extraordinary increase, 2005, in college mental health concerns. And he says, extraordinary increase in serious mental illness on college campuses and what we can do about it. He spoke of concerning rates of depression, binge drinking, suicide, etc. Those things are quite concerning. And I'd like to tell you, oh, that was a decade ago. It's so much better now. But actually, it's more and more concerning. The last 2 years of the Higher Education Research Institute out of UCLA that does national surveys across universities, including Harvard, by the way, is not very promising. It really shows it getting worse, not better, since then. Higher mental health problems than ever before in the freshman class coming in this year and last year, and more depression and weaker social skills overall. A few more gloom and dooms pieces, and then we'll move toward solutions, I promise.
But they surveyed people like me, and they asked, what's the picture looking like? And people say over and over again, about 80% or more in my role, and say it's getting, there's more. It's more severe, more and more serious problems. About a third of campuses having suicides, sometimes a run of suicides, so multiple in a row. And it's more in a lot of different ways. It's more in frequency, meaning like more students are being identified or coming to the counseling center. Severity, they're having more severe mental health struggles than previous eras. And complexity, meaning it's often multi-layered. Yes, they have depression, and they're also plagued, and they're abusing substances, and they have huge family dynamics that play, etc. So you see at places like Pepperdine, great school, by the way, if you're thinking about your kids coming here, don't be discouraged, because this is very much like the national picture. You're not exempt. It is happening here. The good news is resources are available. But like the year before I came to Pepperdine, there were 270 clients. This last year, we saw 756 clients. This year, I think we'll just be slightly above that. But that kind of trend is what's happening nationally.
Some students seeking counseling services.
And then sometimes people will say, oh, well, it's probably just the clients, you know, kind of, you may be getting a distorted perception. But then there's ways to survey the student bodies generally, and you find stats like this, that you have over 50% of students in a year saying they had overwhelming anxiety. About a third, not just being somewhat sad or having moments of depression, but at times feeling so depressed it was difficult to function. So it does seem to be broader than just the clients. And then these researchers have confirmed the anxiety piece. And by the way, that one, even in the last couple of years, is the issue that's come up more, anxiety. It's an age of anxiety. Yeah?
Do you have any sense of that 756 number is repeat?
Those are individual bodies, yeah. Those are people, yeah. Yeah, the number of sessions will be a whole different thing. So, yes, anxiety is increasing, but another couple of findings that are really concerning that we want to begin with and in mind about is narcissism is increasing and empathy is decreasing, right? So think about that. More and more students, kind of growing up, thinking the world revolves around them. And I've learned over time to think differently about that. I used to think of narcissists as kind of such obviously jerky people who thought the world, you know, was theirs and they'd be bossy and mean and whatever. It's often in populations like ours, it's a very, what I call now, nice narcissist. Nice narcissist. They'll call very sweetly and say, I would like a counseling appointment. I would like it today at 2 o'clock. I'll try that with my doctor, you know. Just, hi, I want to give you one time that I'm available and see how that works, and I'd like it to be today. But then, in all seriousness, how this plays out is all different ways. So a day in the life at the counseling center, this could be somebody's slate for the day. They might have their 9 o'clock appointment is a student who's struggling with an eating disorder. Their 10 o'clock appointment might be somebody who's dealing with substance abuse. Their 11 o'clock appointment might be having what they would think of as kind of regretful sexual behavior. Like, why do I keep doing that? I feel stupid. I'm ashamed. I know it's not healthy for me, but I keep doing this. I have lunch. That's some fun to debrief from that. And then their next one might be somebody who's cutting or otherwise self-injuring. And then they might have a suicidal crisis to end the day. I would like to tell you that's dramatic and exaggerated, but it's really not. That is the world of college mental health these days. Do we deal with some homesickness and career angst? Yeah, a little bit, but it's not nearly as much the prevalence as people think. But let's go back to those again. On the surface, it looks like these people would need very different treatment, right? Like, give that person some eating disorder treatment. This guy needs substance abuse. This person, you know, needs some emergency treatment related to the suicidal crisis. And I'm not saying there aren't times for very specialized treatment. Of course there is. But sometimes, a lot of times, they have more in common than they have different. Because think about what's going on here. All of those students may basically struggle with the lack of psychological skills, or what I call muscles, like psychological muscles. Two most important ones that I just see lacking over and over again is the ability to regulate emotion and the ability to sit with distress. So what do these things have in common vis-a-vis that? They work. They work in the short run. If I'm really distressed, I got a bad grade, my parents are yelling at me about money or this or that, and I'm so upset. Well, if I'm binging and purging, for the moment, I'm not thinking about it. If I'm totally wasted for the night after night, I'm not thinking about it then either. For the moment, the sexual pleasure, of course, feels good. I'm nicely distracted, et cetera, et cetera. But, of course, they work in the short run, but they cause more problems in the long run. So I was already distressed and anxious and having fights with my parents about money, and now I have a DUI, and now I'm in trouble with the university, and God forbid, now I've hurt somebody. So what I think students need, and again, remember this at the beginning with the end in mind, I want us to be thinking about how do we get this in so much earlier. Students need to learn to regulate emotions in healthy ways, to be able to use their physical resources, their social resources, their spiritual resources. When stuff happens, right, you don't always get the A, you don't always make the team, you do have breakups that you didn't want, that's life. But the question is, when it happens, do you know how to settle yourself? That's emotional regulation, they need to learn that. And then the other part is the stress tolerance. Sometimes life is hard, and it doesn't matter what you do. It's still going to be hard for a while. Right? Think about the death of a loved one. You can journal, you can pray, you can talk to your friends, and you should. And it's still going to be hard for a while. Distress tolerance is learning that you don't die from sitting with difficult emotions. You actually can die running from difficult emotions. But can you begin to accept difficult emotions? Kind of like a wave. And it comes and goes. If you're right in the middle of it, then good. Kind of accepting it, dealing with things like the Psalms, being in great lament, and then, that's it. And just but letting it be there. I like to paraphrase M. Scott Peck from that old book, Road Less Traveled. He basically said, life is hard. Once you accept that, it's not so hard. And I think a lot of college students, to put it too simply, don't accept that it's that hard. I have some thoughts about why so many are struggling in these ways, but I wonder what you think. What is going on societally, parenting practices, etc.?
Lack of honesty in the home.
Lack of honesty in the home.
Not letting our kids fail.
Not letting them fail. That's what you're going to say. Yes.
I work in a county with children. And it was interesting. We had a school, and it made me laugh because I worked in that school. And they had a workshop I saw talk to parents.
Uh-huh.
No consequences.
Uh-huh.
Parents were always coming in and rescue.
Okay. Right. Is everybody familiar with that term? Helicopter parents, they don't just drop their kids off at college, they stay and hover, right? And guess what? They didn't start at college. Mm-hmm. They're in the hallways of preschool, they're volunteering for every single activity.
I think passive parents is a big thing.
Okay. Yeah.
Not following through, just saying something or something, which is easy.
Right.
Actually following through.
Yeah, it takes more energy, right, to parent well.
The pressure to succeed in every area, academically, athletically.
Divorce. Yeah, divorce certainly can be very painful. I wouldn't want to minimize that, but what's interesting is the rates have not increased lately, so they don't. That doesn't explain the difference, but individually, of course, that's very painful for some. Oh, sorry.
I think of being overwhelmed by the unending number of new inputs from the internet, from the Facebook news feed that it just doesn't end.
Yeah.
There's always something
constant
else.
Constant bad news, right?
As to add to that, they're constantly exposed to a life that's not real.
Okay.
Little snippets that look perfect.
Yeah. From Facebook to reality TV to whatever. Okay. There was one more over here.
I was going along with what she said, just the lack of interaction in the real world and so much interaction with,
social media devices.
Okay. Which, of course, can be good and great resources and wonderful, but can be problematic depending on how they're used.
I wanted to also say, there's no family time anymore with
no.
the whole family together.
Okay. Yeah. Good. You guys have covered most everything that I'll say in the next couple of points, but I think it is. There are a lot of these factors that are huge, hugely influential. First of all, on a positive note, I want to say there's some good reasons that more people are coming to counseling centers. There's less stigma. That's great. There are better medications. So people with physiologically caused major mental illnesses a generation ago might not have been able to go to college. But now, they may with medications. Does that mean they won't need a lot of support and that we might not be monitoring them pretty closely? No. They need that, but they can come. That's a beautiful thing. But then on the negative side, there are so many things, and I think you've covered many of them, so much access to so many images that are disturbing and information that's disturbing. One meta-analysis that puts a lot of studies together to say what are the real issues that a lot of people speculate, but empirically they were able to verify kind of two major areas, and I think a lot of what you said is covered in that. One is a greater sense of threat, and the other is less social support. That's a bad combination. So think about that. People will push back with me a little bit sometimes on the threat thing, like, come on, there were worse times, or, you know, how about World War II? There was a war going on, Great Depression, da-da-da-da-da. But the difference, as was pointed out, it's right in your face. This generation has grown up very aware of all kind of danger, from Ebola to terrorists to the stock market failing to there's not going to be any jobs to da-da-da-da-da-da. If you don't believe that, watch even soft news like Good Morning America or something, for about 5 minutes, and just listen to not only the headline content, but the tone of it. The world is danger. It's kind of the message. So they've grown up with that, and that has an effect. And then secondly, less social support. I'll talk more about the family piece in a moment, because I absolutely agree with that. But just overall, the lack of deeper friendships. Of course, there's variety, but an all-too-common pattern at Pepperdine, as an example, would be students that if you looked at their social calendar or their, you know, their phone calendar, whatever, you would say, wow, that person has a lot of social contact. They have social support. They're in a sorority. They belong to this club. They whatever. But look how tightly it's scheduled. So I got to leave early from this meeting because I got to practice with the debate team. And then I've got to get to this coaching session and da da da. They're busy, but busy is different than friendships. Are people there when you really needed it? Could you call on somebody? Does anybody really know me? And we've had many students, even in public presentations, talk about how, even though they're student leaders, even though people think they've got it all together, how desperately lonely they are with that busy, busy, busy lifestyle. And that's all too common. As was mentioned, the role of technology, in addition to the sort of comparison, unrealistic aspect, there's also just the speed of life, right? The cocaine-like blip that happens to all of us every time we get a text and we got to check the email, and it's so constant, that has an effect. And even in the secular literature, they speak to, there's a spiritual void for many. They're starting to think, like, what is this all for? I worked so hard since third grade or whatever, and what's the point of it? And then, as mentioned, there are some huge family factors, and although divorce is so painful, the rates have stabilized. But what for many is going on now is a more subtle and a more insidious kind of parenting dysfunction. In many ways, they're model parents, but they're sort of over-parenting. They're so making sure their kid's getting into the best preschool, having these tutoring lessons, this music, this whatever. So I'm not surprised that that would be the college student who does the same, right? And then, you know, like one friend of mine said that she was in gymnastics with his kids, and another parent was pulling out the kids early because they were late to swimming lessons. And just that lifestyle, like, what's it doing? And not responding or hearing your own kids' cues. I'll give him Josh an example since he's here. He's a little guy, his first little basketball camp, and he says about, like, Thursday or something, you have a five-day camp, I'll be glad when this camp is over. You know, this is like a little 8 or 9 year old. And I said, oh, it's okay, Josh. It takes practice to get better. He goes, oh, I know I'm good. I'm just too busy. If you listen, they will tell you. But what is missing in this lifestyle? Downtime, imaginative play, family rituals like dinner, opportunities to work things out on their own. You know, how about a little playground play where Johnny gets mad at Billy and they work it out, and they learn to work it out, versus Johnny, tell Billy why you're upset. Billy, oh, you know, there's of course some time for that, but when it's so orchestrated so constantly. And then they don't get the expectation that life will be hard and a deep sense of God with them. I show this to students all the time. This is how you thought your life was going to be. This is reality, right? Life has ups and downs, but they're surprised by the difficulties. They're surprised that it's so hard. They lack the skills to know how to navigate it, and they lack the confidence.
May I ask a question?
Sure.
Okay. I'm an educator, and I'm in schools now where they don't want anything negative said to a child.
Right.
And then I have a sister-in-law who didn't want me to say any negative to my nephews. Is this becoming common to not being real?
I've heard that. I don't know that it's a major parenting thing, but I do, and I would share some of your concerns there. Yeah. I think Carol Dweck's research in that, it's really better to look at, what does she call it, growth mindset versus fixed mindset, right? That's really healthy difference, but getting into that extreme probably not so healthy. So in a nutshell, what's happening is they're raised with too much pressure. You've got to be in the best school, you've got to get this done, you've got your resume building by the time of fifth grade. And then at the same time, too much protection. And it seems like it's paradoxical, like it couldn't go together, but it does go together. These same parents are both pushing really hard, but right there. Let me talk to the coach. You didn't make the team. Oh, let me see what I can do about that. Just kind of trying to work it all out, mediating social conflicts, mediating disappointments, making sure their darlings are not hurt. So I use this metaphor sometimes. It's kind of silly, but I think it makes the point. Imagine someone coming to Pepperdine and saying, oh, I'm going to walk on the basketball team. Do you want a basketball team? Oh, really? Okay, you want to try that. You must have been a star in your high school basketball. Oh, no. I didn't actually play high school basketball. Oh, did you play other sports? Oh, no. I'm not a sports guy. But I want to be one. Okay, so can you let me on the team? Like, it would be ludicrous. Of course they could not perform. Did you work out? No. Okay. As silly as that is, it's not that different than what they do in other regards. Have you had any experience working out your own conflicts? No. Have you had any disappointments? No. Have you ever had to wait for something? No. Right? Okay. Drop you off at college. Good luck with your roommate. Good luck with reality. Good luck with that you're not going to get all A's. Good luck with whatever. They have no experience with that. It's the same thing. They do not have the psychological muscle. So how do you help with that in all different ways? Think about how you can help, certainly by words, but more importantly by experience, to teach kids that sometimes life is hard, that it's okay that it's hard. You get to be mad. You get to be disappointed. You get to have hurt feelings. You get to be angry. That's okay. Welcome to life. And there are ways to calm down. I like to think of it like a bag of tools that a kid can understand that pretty well, or a bag of tricks. Like, what can you do? What's your menu of options? You can go for a run. You could talk to a friend. You could take a hot bath. You could pray together. You could journal. There's a million things you could do. But know that you're going to need that. And by the way, I encourage parents to teach what they do. You may think you're modeling it all the time, but I think sometimes it's good to be explicit about it, as a teaching example. Do you notice when mom gets home, first she often takes a bath before she deals with dinner and the rest of the evening? That's kind of me unwinding and transitioning. You know, something like that. Just everyday life.
I think part of the problem is we're not modeling it.
Exactly.
We don't take the bath.
I'm going to talk about that in a minute. That's exactly right. And then, you know, normalize difficulty. Don't always rush to fix it. So their friend hurt them on the playground, didn't invite them to the birthday party, so do not call the other parent.
why did you not invite my children?
Yeah.
You know what? Sometimes you don't get invited. It's a bar. And not that you don't empathize or help them settle down, but you don't have to fix it. And learning to sit with pain. Again, this too shall pass. God is with you in this. You're still loved. You're still valued. How are you giving those messages? Developing the strength to deal with life's ups and downs, learning to cope, and not doing them a favor by preventing every opportunity to learn to deal with them. You know, think about this passage in Deuteronomy about fix the words of mine in your hearts and minds, tie them in symbols in your hands and bind them on your foreheads. Teach them to your children when you walk along the road, when you lie down, and when you get up. You know, that kind of attitude with teaching just all these emotional regulation pieces, but especially the where is God in this part. I don't think it's a one-time, really serious conversation. I think it's all the time. You know, where is God in this? I'd like to tell you that the students who identify as Christian and very serious about their faith on the intake paperwork look very different, but unfortunately they often don't at the Counseling Center. They even can use their faith kind of against themselves or not be making the connections to real life. So I think about what would be helpful with younger children. How are you helping kids and adolescents have that deep, deep sense, and the psychological research is clear about this, that faith, although the field wanted to kind of not acknowledge how positive it could be, had a little bit of a negative bias for some years, now it would say, oh yeah, there's good research that if you have a deep sense of like God with you, that's probably most important. And are we remembering that part when we're sending them to Sunday school and make sure they're behaving right and da 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 da? Are they also getting the God with you, God always with you, whether you're in college or at home, whether you're kindergarten and missing mom and dad, or whether you're home, like how do they get that sense? That's so important. Of course, the spirit of grace. I hope faith gives perspective taking. This is one exam in one semester in one class of your undergraduate experience of the entirety of your life, of the entirety of your eternity. Like, keep it in perspective. Sure, you want to do your best, but is it the end of the world if you're not? How do you press on toward the goal set before you? And I think from a Christian worldview, and again, think about how you get this in the minds of the younger kids, there will be suffering. There will be struggles in this world. This world is not our home, kind of idea. So that has implications both for myself. Like, I should not be shocked when there's loss, when there's pain, when there's sadness, when there's disappointment. And it should help me to be empathic and compassionate with others because others are suffering too, and motivate service. What's not so helpful from a mental health perspective is if you have primarily a kind of sinners in the hands of an angry God kind of attitude, like that if you parent your kids like they are one step from eternal damnation, turns out not so good for mental health, right? It can create some anxiety. But also to have it only be task-oriented. Like, you gotta read your Bible, you gotta brush your teeth, you gotta vacuum your room. Like, really, like, don't frame it like that. Of course there are spiritual disciplines. Of course we want to encourage those. But that's different than just, like, it's one more thing on the list. It's all of our life. And similarly, don't be so performance-oriented with it all. And I see that with some of our students here. They're doing resume building in a whole other way. Okay, I'll be a campus ministry intern, and I'll go to this service project, and I'll da 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 da, and I'll belong to three different faith communities, and I'll, amen. Are you ever being still and knowing that He's God? Of course, I want to be in a Christian community, but to what end? One way I think about coping for myself, for my clients, and that I think we can teach pretty young is, what is coping in its essence? It's basically three parts. Understanding the problem accurately, like what's really going on here, engaging in competent action, and managing troublesome emotions, right? So here at the college level, I might have the, I don't know if I'm going to graduate, if I don't pass this class, I don't know if they're going to let me in, my parents already bought their tickets. You know, we hear variations like that and a million others. Okay, you don't know. Okay, so did you talk to the registrar? Like, let's get some information. Are you able to walk even if you don't pass this class at the grade level that you were hoping?
Or is that just your fantasy, your worry? Then, okay, let's gauge in common action. Yes, you can walk. All you have to do is fill out this one acceptable. Okay, let's do that. And you need to settle down. Let's talk about how you can settle down. Okay? That's the 20-year-old version. What's the 6-year-old version?
I left my worksheet at home. Miss Smith is going to kill me. Or, you know, I'm not going to get done. They're not going to let me on the playground. It's going to be a disaster. I don't know where my worksheet is.
Okay. Let's think about it. Who did you ride home with? Don't solve it for them. Don't go grab the worksheet. Think it through. Okay, what could you do? If you just can't find it, how might you talk to Miss Smith? You might miss recess. It could be okay. How can you settle down about it? Right? Just basic life skills. Perfectionism.
It's so easy when you stand up there and say it.
Yeah, and my kids will tell you that I did it perfectly too. Actually, it's funny. Josh was way easier parenting just as far as navigating a lot of this. His sister was a little more challenging in some regards. Sweet, sweet soul now. That was sweet then too, sometimes. And at our own church, they used to say, because I taught parenting classes for a while, and they said, after Hannah was born, they said, now we want to see you teach a parenting class. So please know I do walk with a real leader. You want to be careful about the difference between high standards and perfectionism, both for yourself and your kids. Like, why do you want them to never get anything but an A? Why? Are you trying to help your kids use the gifts and talents and develop them fully and have be a good steward of what God's given them? Or are you trying to prove something to somebody? I think it's a little soul-searching, but you want to think about those kinds of things. You know, is it proving yourself? Is it getting a balanced life way out of whack? And then stay close, but not too close. Letting go should be a gradual process. Dropping them off at college should not be the first time they're going to learn about you. Don't do it all at once. It's another paradox. Attachment is critical to healthy development. You want your kids to be really well attached. And you need to allow age-appropriate individuation. And that sounds paradoxical, but from young ages, it's been shown to be true. Like little 3 and 4 year olds in a playroom study. The kids that were most securely attached to their moms and dads could be with mom and dad, and then, you know, they're starting to explore. Those toys look interesting. Maybe I'll go check this out. And they check back every now and then, but they feel confident to explore the playroom. You worry about the ones who could care less whether mom and dad are there. That's not a good sign. Or the ones who cannot possibly leave mom and dad's side. Okay, so I tell the college parents, even during an interview, it's the same thing in college. It's just the playground got a little bigger. All of LA, international programs, etc. But because they have the secure attachment with you, they can look back and they can go to Heidelberg. And they can look back and they can take on a challenge. But in addition to the relationship with you, like some of you said, you want them early on to develop real relationships with other people, with people in your church, adults and peers, with people at school, with people in the neighborhood. The idea that they can look someone in the eye, have conversation, have deep empathy. Do not raise your children like they're the center of the world and no one else matters. Right? Like, how do you raise them to be able to have real conversations? I love Mary Piper's book, In the Shelter of Each Other. She talks about this over and over again, verified in research, that social support makes all the difference in dealing with little things in life or huge things in life. We were created to be in the shelter of each other. Life is hard, but we need each other. And if people don't have each other, as they're in college and beyond, they're going to be pretty lost. She also encourages, by the way, limiting what she called then, it's a little outdated book, but box time, any kind of box, computer, TV, etc. Now there's even more options of that. And supporting empathy. So when your kid's upset with another kid, how do you think they're feeling? What do you think might be going on there? Yes.
Sorry, going back to social support, I have an 8-year-old. I can't picture him having social support other than mom and dad. So what do you mean with that? Junior high?
Well, I would hope that it's the beginning, like that they might have a friend that they like to hang out with, that they enjoy downtime with somebody. They may not be having the most intimate, deepest, darkest adult conversation, but do they take turns? Do they listen to the other? Those kinds of things. And then are there maybe some other adults, like at church, that they start to get to know and trust? And the idea that there's some people out there that are in your corner kind of feeling is what you're looking for. And as somebody mentioned, watch your own life. How are you doing? They're watching you. Can you roll with the ups and downs in life, or did you expect it to be like this and you're mad when it's not? Are you a perfectionist? And does your faith ground you? Or is it one more area in which you're trying to be busy and perfectionistic, et cetera, only? Do you have that deep sense of God with you? Or no real connection? And are you in your own life beginning with the end in mind? So it's important that you think about that. So to kind of summarize, I think I would just encourage you to raise your kids with a deep, deep sense of God with them. That life can be great, and there will be problems, but they can be solved. Tough times, but they can be endured. Relationships need to be treasured, and then the adventures are endless. So this becomes not, oh no, it's horrible, but oh, wow, life is kind of a roller coaster, isn't it? And there's some excitement and adventure and heartache and joy and laughter and tears, and that is life. And God is with us in that. So thanks very much. I'd be happy to take a few questions if we have about 5 minutes. Any questions or comments? Yeah.
I just wanted to make a quick comment, but I do agree that our society just looks at it differently. I'm trying to teach my kids that if they don't pick up their lunch on their way out the door, then they're not going to have lunch. But the school will not stop feeding them free peanut butter and jelly sandwiches. You know, like, stop rescuing my kid. He'll be okay if he misses a meal.
Okay.
No, I'm trying to teach a lesson here.
Right, right. So, and finding that sweet spot, right?
Yeah.
And letting them suffer at the level that they're able to developmentally, right?
Yeah.
So make your other lunches so much better that peanut butter is a huge disappointment. All right. What else? Other comments? Yes.
What would you recommend for someone reading on resilience? I think that's kind of a hot topic right now for you want to raise kids who resilient.
Yeah, yeah.
But
can you give us some for that? Kind of a selfless plug. I'm working on one right now. And I've seen a lot of things that are related, but to be honest, I haven't found quite the piece. That's why I kind of found my niche. Right? There is a good book called How to Raise an Adult. It's not from a Christian point of view. It's written from a Stanford dean who observes many of these things. I really do like Carol Dweck's thing of growth view, et cetera. There's several pieces like that. There's a lot about bullying and how parents are overreacting to bullying, bullying nation, et cetera. So a lot of those have implications for resilience. There's some in the Jewish literature that are things like, what is it called? The blessing of a skinned knee. That's kind of sweet. Or for older adolescents, it's like the blessing of a B+, something like that. Mm-hmm. You know, the idea of it's okay to have some discipline. So I think there's some that are speaking to it.
What's yours? What's it going to be?
It's going to be preparing your kids for college. It's not what you think. Mm-hmm. Another title I put in is raising resilience. So just like, is it bad? Or, you know, is it specific?
Raising resilience.
Raising resilience.
I like that.
Yeah. Yeah. Thanks for the If you want to email me, I'd be happy to give you some specific references. Yeah, and I also like ones that are for kids. They don't need to say this is resilience, but like there's one called When Sophie Gets Angry, Very, Very Angry. And I love that book. It's a beautiful physical book, but it just kind of shows Sophie's getting ticked off. There. She has a fight with her sister, and she goes to cool off, basically, in a tree. Viewing nature, et cetera, comes back, works it out. But it's just a beautiful message. Or the Berenstain Bears, too busy, or something like that. And there's one called Ish. So this perfectionistic little big brother is drawing all these pictures, and he's throwing them away, and he doesn't like it. And the little sister comes along and puts them up, tapes them all over the room, and he doesn't like that. He says, these aren't good enough. That was supposed to be a tree. It doesn't look like a tree. And she says, it's tree-ish. That was supposed to be a dog. It doesn't even look like a good dog. It dog-ish. Just so sweet, and she totally approves. So I like little books like that, too, for the kids.
What about books for young adults? So you have childhood, and you have some for parents, but what about young adults and how to help them if we maybe didn't do all this stuff perfectly?
Yeah. You know, I haven't found that either. I teach a mental health first year seminar, and I use pieces again. So, like, this book about managing anxiety, this book about whatever, but I know I haven't seen one yet.
So maybe another book in your future.
Yeah. In spare time, I'm just going to be careful with that. No, thank you. I am interested in that, actually.
I'm curious if you ever see a case of very healthy, resilient parents who raise non-resilient children.
Sure. And let me be clear, too. Like, I'm talking about a trend I'm observing. There's infinite examples, and I would be remiss. I should have said this before. There are kids that, for whatever reason, you know, they have their own brain chemistry stuff going on. They were exposed to some traumatic event through no fault of the parents, et cetera. So they may have much more to deal with. So I don't want to imply that it's so easy, not to mention just the personality differences that you see with it. So sometimes, yes. And sometimes it looks like it's that, and then you listen to a little bit more, and it's less that way. For example, when I first started this work at another university, during the very first week of orientation, we had a suicide attempt of a freshman. And we were at the hospital calling mom, et cetera, having the meetings after. And mom was initially saying, so shocking, so surprising, so whatever. I don't know. She's gone to camp. She's gone to Europe with band trip. She's gone to this. She's gone to that. I'm so surprised. But she was saying, I can't do this, clearly. I mean, she was saying it with her words and her actions. I cannot do this. I cannot be on my own yet. And but then the more I talked to mom, I found out mom always went to camp. Mom went to that Europe trip. Mom went to, you know, mom was always there. So this kid had no experience with separation. So sometimes it looks like that. It's not quite like that. Okay. Thank you very much.